If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On the 16th of March 1190, the Clifford's Tower massacre led to the deaths of all of York's Jewish population. Dean Irwin, a scholar of England's medieval Jews, talks to our content director, David Musgrove, about this terrible event and the wider story of the Jewish residents of medieval England.
Today, we are talking about the events that happened at Clifford's Tower in March 1190. And I'm joined by Dean Irwin, who is an expert on this topic. So, Dean, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming. Thank you for joining. Can you give us an introduction first? Just drop us in to the story. Tell us what happened at Clifford's Tower, which is in York, in March 1190.
So on the 16th and 17th of March 1190, the Jews of medieval York died, all of them died, either at their own hands or at the hands of people who were attacking them. They sought refuge in the castle because a few weeks earlier, it's difficult to say precisely when, but presumably at some point in early March, various people had attacked the house of Benedict of York. They pillaged it and they killed his wife and widow. And sort of seeing which way the wind was blowing, the Jews quite quickly sought refuge in Clifford's Tower. And this was a particularly difficult position for them to be in because the castellan of Clifford's Tower at the time was a man called Richard Malbess, who was heavily indebted to the Jews. So he's not the best person to be looking after the Jews. And actually, he left the castle at one point and they basically seized it and refused to let him back in. So as a result of this, the sheriff of Yorkshire, a man called Richard Marshall, called out lots of local knights and people to besiege the castle and retake it. and seeing what was going to happen effectively, they were either going to die or be forced to convert, the Jews opted to take their own lives. So the men slit the throats of their wives and children and then took their own lives. And any that didn't die on that evening of the 16th to the 17th were lured out with promises of their lives by the besiegers, but ultimately were massacred because they had no interest in sparing the Jews, even if they did convert. And from there, sort of the attackers went to York Minster, where they burned the records of their indebtedness to the Jews. So it's part of a two-stage attack. First, you kill the creditors and the Jews, and then you burn the records of your indebtedness and try to get off scot-free, effectively.
Right. There's quite a lot in there. There's a few things that we need to unpack. So clearly, a violent and vicious assault. How many people were involved? How many Jewish people lived in York at the time? Do we know?
So the population of York, the York Jewry, was around 150 men, women, and children, and they all died when that attack happened, either by their own hand or by the hands of the attackers.
And that's the total Jewish population of York, we think, who perished in this event?
Yes, effectively the entire community is wiped out.
Okay, so again, a further evidence of the brutality of this event. You mentioned Benedict of York there. Who was he?
He was really one of the great Jews of 12th century England. He'd actually died a few weeks earlier as a result of attacks in London. The attack in York isn't an isolated event. It's part of a wide sweep of attacks on the Jews, which really start after Richard I's coronation in early September 1189. And Benedict of York is at that event, and he is forced to convert then and does, but then reneges on his conversion and basically dies of his wounds on the way back to York. But he's one of the great Jews, so the fact that his house is attacked, it's probably one of the big stone houses, which is probably very difficult to get into, which again gives the other Jews time to escape. And it's also the place where you're likely to have the most money, and thus it is well worth attacking and plundering.
And you just mentioned then that this event in York is not an isolated event. There have been other attacks on other Jewish communities in cities around England. So Lincoln, I think, was another one. So what happened where?
So the attack on the London Jewry occurs on the 3rd to the 4th of September at the coronation. And after that, Richard the First issues orders that the Jews aren't to be attacked. And that might have worked had he remained in the country to enforce it. But shortly thereafter, he leaves for Normandy and then for the Crusades. So there's no one really in England to enforce these orders. And effectively, violence sweeps up the country. And places like Lincoln are attacked, but also Stamford. At Bury, the Jews are protected by the local abbot, but then expelled by him. So it's quite a nasty business. And basically, they sweep all the way north up to York. But York is definitely the largest community that's attacked, and it's also the only one, really, that is totally wiped out by the attack.
OK. So we've got a little bit of a scene setting here. We're in the reign of Richard I, Richard the Lionheart, the famous Crusader king. And as you said, who didn't spend that much time in England during his reign. You told us he went off to Normandy and then off to Crusades. He's famous for not actually being in England very much during his reign. Can we get a little bit more insight into the nature of the Jewish community in England in totality? Am I right in thinking that Jewish people were invited into England by William the First, William the Conqueror, after 1066?
That seems to be the case. It's quite difficult to say when they actually arrive in England. So it's certainly sometime after the conquest, and it's either in the reign of William the Conqueror or in the reign of his son, William Rufus. So there's certainly a community in London by 1095. And that's really the only community in London for the next half century. And then in the reign of King Stephen, the Jews tend to move out of London and settle in other urban locations like Norwich, like Lincoln, and sort of in this central and eastern point. And then in 1159, there's a second wave of settlement of England, which includes places like York and like Canterbury. And it's really in Henry II's reign that we start to see the blossoming of Jewish communities in various parts of England. And York is born out of that second wave of settlement.
This is slightly out of your research area, so you may not know the answer. But is there no evidence really for any Jewish people in England prior to the Normans?
No, there isn't. There are some isolated evidence that there might have been Jews in England in the Roman period, but actually there's no substantive evidence of Jews in England pre-1066. Now, that's not to say that people didn't think about the Jews and they weren't aware of them, and they might have encountered them on the continent, but there's no official established community in England before the conquest. It's really a product of the Norman conquest. And that's a really nice thing about studying the Jews of medieval England, because it's bookended by two definitive dates. You've got 1066 at the beginning and you've got 1290 at the end.
Sure, 1290 being the expulsion of the Jews, which we will get to shortly. Well, maybe not so soon. We've got a fair bit to cover. So the Jews who came to England, where did they come from? Where were they based prior to coming here?
The Jews predominantly come from Rouen, the capital of Normandy, with the Conqueror. And for the first sort of period of its life, the Anglo-Jewish community is basically an offshoot of the Rouen Jewry. The same people who live in London live in Rouen, and they have houses there. This changes after 1135, when it's much more difficult to have cross-channel relations because of the anarchy. But effectively, the Jews will always remain part French, effectively. They have strong relations with French Jewry after 1135, and even after 1204, there's still, and 1204 and the loss of Normandy, there's still connections between the Jews of England and the Jews of France. But this is weakened as you go on further, because the Jews become further ingrained into English society.
And you mentioned the anarchy there, just as a reminder to our listeners. So that's the event 1135 to 1154, Stephen and Matilda battling for control of England, and a lot of violence going on there. These Jewish people, they were coming from Normandy. Were they speaking Norman French? Was that their language of choice?
Yes, originally they would have spoken Norman French. They seem to speak French throughout the 12th and 13th centuries as their preferred language, as well as Hebrew, obviously, within a community, and possibly Latin, and probably some English as well.
So what size of community did we have by the later 12th century then? Can you put a number on how many Jewish people were living in England?
Yeah, so historians calculate that there were around 5,000 individual Jews in England by sort of the end of the 12th century, and this is really the peak of the size of the community.
Given the events that that we started with, this violent event, that clearly implies tension between the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community. How far is that tension manifested before 1189 and 1190? What can you tell us about what goes on before that?
Well, the first thing to remember is that Medieval England is an incredibly diverse place. So in that respect, it's not unusual to have people that are from outside the community within medieval towns. But the Jews are the only religious minority who are technically allowed to live in medieval Christian Europe. So in that respect, they always occupy quite a difficult position. And there are tensions. The tensions tend to be more prevalent with people from outside the towns, because these are people who've never met a Jew, so have no idea what a Jew is beyond what they've been told in the pulpit. But by the 12th century, it's been becoming increasingly common to accuse the Jews of the act of deicide, i.e. killing Christ. The Jews are also becoming increasingly involved in fields which are sort of becoming less popular for Christians, like money lending at interest. There's a clampdown on Christians lending money throughout the 12th century, and that's a gap that some Jews can fill. So there's a slight tension here, which is both religious and economic, that the Jews occupy quite a privileged, if precarious, position in English society.
So sort of using modern terminology, which may not be appropriate, I suppose they were quite othered, were they? Did they stand out in the community?
If you were part of the community, I expect not. Jews don't tend to have any distinguishing clothes or features, which is why in the 13th century, various regimes tried to get the Jews to wear an official badge, the so-called tabula, which represents the two tablets of Mosaic law. And this is really the only way that you can distinguish a Jew from a non-Jew, because actually they live together, they go to the same places. In the 12th century, we even get accounts in chronicles of Jews walking freely through churches. So in that respect, Jews will be where Christians are, and it's not easy to tell the difference visibly between the two.
And sort of linguistically as well, going back to the point you said about the language they were using, I guess it wouldn't have been that unusual for people to be speaking Norman French in towns and cities either.
No, and although we don't have evidence for it, they probably spoke English as well, because if you're going to deal with people on a daily basis, you need to be able to speak with them and communicate with them. And actually, there's some really wonderful evidence of people drinking together, Christians and Jews drinking together. So in order to do that, implicitly, you need to be able to communicate, and that is as likely to be in English as in French, but it's difficult to say which.
You mentioned sort of accusations of deicide earlier. We haven't talked about the question of the blood libel. What's that, and how does that play into the story?
The blood libel or the ritual murder allegation is an incredibly pernicious anti-Semitic allegation. It basically claims that somewhere in Europe, every year the Jews abduct a child and murder him in parody of Christ's crucifixion. Now, this is entirely fictitious, and it's always been entirely fictitious, but it first appears at Norwich in 1144, when a boy called William of Norwich, his body was found in Fortwood, just outside the city, and the Jews were quickly accused of this crime. And it's important to note that then, as now, we recognise this was a false accusation. Most people don't believe it, even in the 12th century. And the cults of the ritual murder children never take off, so that's a good indication that they're not believed. But truth has never really gotten in the way of a good story. So there are 13 at least 13 accusations of ritual murder between 1144 and the expulsion of the Jews from 1290. So although untrue, it's a convenient allegation to level against the Jews, particularly if the body of a child is found and there's no explanation of how he died.
And am I right in thinking that the Jewish community technically belonged to the king? Is that a correct reading of events?
Yes, it is technically true. The Jews occupy a slightly precarious position in England legally. This has its benefits, so the Jews are protected, the crown will enforce Jewish rights, but equally it has its drawbacks. Most notably, the crown can really exploit the Jews to its own will, and that's particularly problematic because, unlike with some other minority groups in medieval England, the crown didn't need permission to tax Jews in the way that it would have needed for other groups.
So does that mean the Jews were subject to particularly onerous taxation?
In the 12th century, on the whole, no. The first person to recognise the financial potential of the Jews is sort of Henry II. And originally, he borrows money from the Jews, but later on realises that if he taxes them, he can get the money without the disadvantage of having to repay it. Now, under a financially sensible king, that's fine, but under an uncareful king, it can actually be really damaging to Jewish finances. And that's where King John becomes a bit of a problem. His reign is not good for the Jews, but then again, it's not good for anyone. But he really does tax them quite heavily for the first time. Most notably, in 1210, you've got the Bristol Tallage, which demands 60,000 marks from the Jews. And there's some terrible stories which come out of that, including one unfortunate Bristol Jew who had a molar knocked out every day for a week until he agreed to pay what had been assessed on him. And basically, on the eighth day, he agrees to that he'll pay the money that he's supposed to pay. And then in Henry III's reign, it's when it gets really bad, because Henry, during the 1240s and 50s, effectively does annual high-level taxation upon the Jews. And over that period, he extracts roughly 100,000 marks from the community, which is about a third of the overall coinage which was in circulation at the time. And it reduced a lot of Jews to the point of bankruptcy. And actually, they never recovered from that heavy annual financial exactions throughout the 13th century.
Right. Okay. That's fascinating. We've got slightly ahead of ourselves, so we need to step back just a moment. Back to 1189 and 1190. So we talked quite a lot there about the context and the place of Jewish people in England in the 12th century. And we talked about debt. We've talked about these fictitious accusations of blood libel. We've talked about some general tension between Christians and Jews throughout the period. What specifically, and apologies, we've already covered this, but what specifically sparked off the events of 1189? Why were Jews targeted following Richard I's accession?
That, again, is a difficult question to answer because there are lots of factors that go into this. But Crusades are always accompanied by attacks on the Jewish communities. We see this in the First and Second Crusades. It's not really a problem then for England because we don't have a heavy involvement in those ventures. But the Third Crusade is different. We are one of the main players in that. So one wonders why you'd go 2,000 miles away or however far the Holy Land is when actually you can kill infidel at home. And also, in order to fund your own crusading endeavours, you usually have to borrow money. And this can be from the Jews. And it's never going to go down well if you have to indebt yourselves to the enemies of Christ in order to go and kill infidel and reclaim the Holy Land.
So, as you say, it's complicated, but clearly a desire to rid themselves of debt did in some way drive what happened in York, because as you said, the people who rioted then went on their way to York Minster and attempted to burn the evidence of the debts that they had to the Jews. So presumably a desire to expunge evidence of debt is a driver here.
Absolutely. I think that's that's where the social dimension comes into this. People at all levels of society borrow money from the Jews, but the people who are particularly involved in the attacks on the York Jewry are the Knights of Yorkshire, and these are, again, the people most likely to be burdened by debt.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And actually, the limited impact of the attack can be seen in the fact that by 1195, there was a Jewish population in Yorkshire again. And actually, by the early decades of the 13th century, the largest community in England would be York.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
So going back to the start of the conversation, so the imperiled Jewish population in York, they take refuge in Clifford's Tower. And Clifford's Tower today is a fine stone keep. It wasn't a fine stone keep in 1190, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was a fine wooden keep, which was really a relic of the late 11th century. And it must have been... It's also an incredibly small site when you go there. So to cram 150 men, women and children who were very scared and very desperate into that space must have been really terrifying. And because it's of Mott and Bailey construction, effectively the Jews would have had a bird's eye view of their attackers gathering around the bottom of the tower, which cannot have improved their optimism for the situation. And it would have become very clear, from the outset of that gathering, that they were going to lose. So, yes, it's a wooden keep, which would have been giving them a perfect view of what was going to happen.
So it must have been, as you say, terrifying for the people inside. What do we know about the specifics of the event? Are there accounts that detail precisely what went on?
So obviously, these have some license because no Jews survived the attack, so you don't have actual inside view. But chroniclers do comment on it, both Christian and Hebrew people comment on it. And from these, we get more or less the same image. All Jews die, largely by their own hands. Again, that's an important point that comes through both chronicle traditions. But we also know that they set fire to both their possessions, not wanting the attackers to get them, but also to the castle as well. And it effectively reduces the castle quite significantly. So there's fire going on, there's smoke everywhere, presumably, and then you start killing each other. And it's just not a nice place to be.
So it doesn't take very long before the entire Jewish population is deceased. That is the consequence of this atrocity. And then rioters go to the Minster, and do they manage to burn the evidence?
Oh, yes, they're very successful at it. They do it right in the middle of the church.
So do they manage to expunge the evidence then? Does they rid themselves of their debt?
They rid themselves of the debt to the Jews, but King Richard is quite rightly not happy about the attack, so he sends an army north to restore order and the king's peace to York. And heavy fines are imposed upon the citizenry of York who have fined are according to their individual wealth rather than their role in the attacks. The knightly classes and those of higher status had quite bravely retreated to Scotland to avoid the king's wrath and later made their peace with the king. But again, they were fined. And to some extent, this is all that could be done, fines, and heavy fines at that, because you can't execute everyone who's been involved.
Mm. You preempted my next question, which was, what was the punishment for the people of York? So heavy fines. Was there any evidence of sort of a penitential attitude from anybody?
If there was, there's no evidence of it. I also think probably that there was this, it was pragmatic, that this had happened and they were going to pay their fines and move on.
So that leads on to a topic that you tackle in your thesis, which is the paradox of Jewish history. How does this event lead to the paradox of Jewish history? And indeed, what is that paradox?
Yes, so it's been argued by historians, basically, that as a direct result of the attack on York, and particularly the burning of the debts, when Richard returns from the Crusades, he establishes what is known as the archive system, which is basically a system of chests whereby debts are recorded and the crown keeps a copy. Now, that's not a terribly convincing argument, because putting debts in a wooden box is no more effective than putting them in the middle of a church in terms of protecting them. So in that respect, this is part of a much wider systematic reform at the top of government, whereby everything's coming under scrutiny. But the Crown certainly does require that debts be recorded from 1194 onwards. And quite a lot of those records survive.
And is this the Exchequer of the Jews?
No, the Exchequer of the Jews is sort of set up to administer that system effectively. It's a system, it's a department of government which the Crown uses to regulate the Jewish community, to collect taxes from the community, but also there's a law court associated with the Exchequer of the Jews where cases involving debt can be heard, and quite a lot of the proceedings of the Exchequer of the Jews do relate to debt. The Crown nominally expected that any case which involved a dispute between a Christian and a Jew be heard in a royal court. Now, there are exceptions to that, and people don't always follow that precedent, but effectively the court is established to facilitate disputes between Christians and Jews.
And what, so in the light of this bloody massacre in 1190, what's the consequence of the relationship between Christians and Jews thereafter? Presumably the Jewish population is in fear. Do Jews try and protect themselves? Do they, you know, go into some sort of defensive routine? What happens?
I mean, I'm not sure what the Jews could do. They're not an armed population. They're not a large population either. So it's not as if they can do anything. But actually, I think it had almost no impact upon the Jews whatsoever. Certainly people knew about it. They recognised that it was terrible. But also they recognised that there was very little that could be done about it. And actually, the limited impact of the attack can be seen in the fact that by 1195, there was a Jewish population in Yorkshire again. And actually, by the early decades of the 13th century, the largest community in England would be York. So in that respect, it grows back very quickly. And I think also, actually, these things only really happen at times when royal authority is its weakest. So in 1190, Rich is out of the country. We see it again in 1264, 1265, when Simon de Montfort's rabble attacked the Jews. But this is when the royal authority is its weakest. When you've got a strong king who can assert himself, actually the Jews don't need to worry about attacks of any kind. And also, just as a final point, what we see in the 13th century is not Jews being attacked by their neighbours. If you live with people in close confines, they tend not to be the people who attack you. The people who attack are the people from outside the region who don't really know yet, who have this idea of what a Jew is as opposed to knowing actual Jewish people. And I think that's where it becomes particularly dangerous for Jews, and these are the most people most likely to get caught up in crusading further as well.
Nevertheless, it is quite hard to comprehend how Jewish people could be going back and living in York only a few years after this terrible attack, when people were singled out specifically because of the religion that those, you know, the Jewish people who then went to the city followed. That it's quite hard to fathom how that could happen. If that was you or me, you know, would you go somewhere where you knew only a few years earlier that someone had been singled out and murdered or caused to commit suicide because of the faith that they followed?
Yes, in the modern world, we'd have the option to go somewhere else. But equally, where else are the Jews going to go? They are in Christendom. This is founded on Christianity, and actually, if they want to live in a region and have the protections afforded by that, they don't have a great deal of choice of where else they can go.
Right. So let's charge on a bit. We need to get to the end of the story. We've talked a bit about what happens through the 13th century, and particularly about debts and money lending. You outlined a bit there. I wonder if you can take us up to the 1290 expulsion. How does that come about, and how does that follow from 1190, if at all?
So in older scholarship, the route from 1190 to 1290 was quite a short one. It was seen that the Jews really never recovered from the 1190, but actually they did, and they prospered in the early decades of the 13th century. But it's in the reign of Edward I that things again go from bad to worst. So in 1275, having returned from Crusade, Edward effectively imposes wholesale legislative reform on the Jews, which basically regulates where they can live, what they can do, what they have to wear, but also stops them lending money at interest. And this is really the beginning of the end for the Jewish community. It's not helped in 1278-9 when you have the so-called coin-clipping pogrom, where hundreds of Jews are executed by the Crown for the crime of coin-clipping. And really, a decade after those events, the Jews are expelled from England in 1290. The order to expel the Jews is issued on the 18th of July, And it comes into effect on the 1st of November, All Saints' Day. And although the Jews are allowed to leave with their movable goods and given affordable passage out of England, they effectively have to go quite quickly, and they're not allowed to return until the mid-17th century.
Okay, wrapping up, you can have a nice day out at Clifford's Tower today. I've spent a lot of time in York. I've been there many times, and it's got lots of good heritage attractions. It's a good historic day out. And the castle, the nice round tower on top of the Mott, is a good place to go. There's some redevelopment going on there right now, I think, from English Heritage doing some work on it. How, as a scholar of Anglo-Jewish history, medieval history, how do you think the story is told clearly enough in the castle? Do people get this sense that that some pretty nefarious activities have gone on there in the past?
Yes, they do. The wonderful work done by Tony Griffiths for her PhD thesis a few years ago actually showed wonderfully the brilliant job that English Heritage have done in recent years. In 1978, there was a plaque unveiled at the foot of the Clifford's Tower, which you now walk past as you go up the stairs to the keep. But also you've got the often hidden memorial of the daffodils on the mound, which appear every spring. And I think actually that's much more important because it reflects the Star of David, but also it shows the renewal and continuity of the Jewish community. The Jews after 1190 sprung back up relatively quickly and lived and prospered in York for the rest of the 13th century. And I think it's a lovely metaphor, the daffodils, for the Jews of York in 1190.
Absolutely. Right. That's gone over all my questions. I wonder, is there anything I've not given you a chance to say, or any sort of summarising, concluding points you'd like to finish with?
Yeah, I'd just say that we've talked a lot about negative history. This is what Saul Baron termed the lachrymose conception of Jewish history, but actually Jewish history can also be quite beautiful. And in our rush to sort of say that the events of 1190 were horrific, and they absolutely were, we shouldn't necessarily forget that this wasn't the whole story of England's Jews. There are some beautiful chapters in England's Jewish history, and they deserve exploring as well.
That was Dean Irwin of Canterbury Christchurch University. If you want to know more about the events Dean discussed in today's episode, there's a feature on our website, historyextra.com. Just search for Clifford's Tower. The link is also in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow to hear the first episode in our new Bayeux Tapestry series.